Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
In the year 2012, we take it for granted that Christianity is one of the world's major religions. What many people don't realize, though, is how major of a religion it really is. Current estimates of the global Christian population hover around 2.8 billion among a world population of 7 billion. This is all the more astounding when you consider that this was a religion that started with a handful of guys who eventually attracted a few hundred followers in the first years of its existence some two millennia ago. Add to this that the Jesus movement, as some have referred to it, started in a backwater corner of the Roman Empire, not necessarily a place one would think of as conducive to the rise of a major religious movement. And that movement also faced repeated bouts of severe persecution from surrounding religions and secular officials. And yet, here we are today with Christianity comprising about 40% of the world's population, making it the world's largest faith tradition. So how do we get to this point? Holding the possibility of the miraculous aside for a moment, what sociological factors explain the triumph of Christianity? To help us assess these questions, I'm very pleased today to be joined by one of my favorite scholars and authors, Rodney Stark, who recently wrote a book entitled The Triumph of Christianity: How the Jesus Movement Became the World's Largest Religion. Rod has been a guest before on the show talking about one of his other books, God's Battalions, The Case for the Crusades, and is author of more than a dozen, perhaps two dozen other books, and an uncountable number of articles on a wide array of topics related to religion. We'll link to a number of those books on our website, and we invite you to check it out. It should also be revealed that Rod is the co-founder and director, along with Byron Johnson, of Baylor's Institute for Studies of Religion, the proud sponsor of our podcast. Finally, I must add that Rod has had a very profound impact through his scholarship and through personal conversations as to how I conduct my own research and view the world. Rod, welcome to Research on Religion.
Well, thank you for having me.
Your book, The Triumph of Christianity, is, by your own admission, an expansion and rethinking of one of your earlier works, The Rise of Christianity. And in that latter book, it was really a landmark work in that it applied some basic ideas within the sociology of religion that you had been formulating for several years to explain what many folks either saw as miraculous or perhaps less miraculous but still surprising, and that's the rise of Christianity. So what motivated you to do this expansion and rethinking of your earlier work?
Well, I suppose it was growing up in a sense. That book was my first venture into history from sociology, and it was very limited in its scope. It starts about the year 40 because I didn't feel competent to deal with the Christ story or with things like the accuracy of the Gospels and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And it ended with the rise of Constantine because I wasn't really prepared to go any further. Then through the years, I wrote other books that educated me, in a sense. And finally, I realized I wanted to take a look at the whole spectrum of the rise of Christianity, bringing it to current times.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason is, I mean, this is not just another history of the rise of Christianity, which is almost always institutional. The focus is on the inner workings of the church, if you will, church councils and theological disputes and, you know, the battles over the papacy and that sort of thing. It struck me that this was not very central to the story, really, but that what was really going on in the world around the church and what the church was affecting in the world around it is a much more interesting story. So I decided to do it, and there's only really focus on the parts that I found interesting.
You make an interesting observation there in that a lot of previous histories of Christianity really just focus on the institutional aspects of it. They go from theologian to theologian or from pope to pope, in large part because those are the folks that actually were writing the history at the time, and us later historians and sociologists look back at that and just duplicate that what is going on. But again, Christianity not just entails the institution, but all these different people, right?
Yeah, well, you know, and the enormous impact of the church on the rise of modernity, if you uh-huh. will. Why did science only happen in the Western world? Because Christianity was absolutely essential to the birth of science.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the kinds of things I wanted to deal with, and it was a lot of fun.
Yes, that's pretty cool. Now, you are covering a lot of ground here, and in today's podcast, we're only going to take it from the early history of Christianity up through about the Constantine era, so the first basically 300 years or so, and that's where the rise of Christianity was talking about. You said you picked up that story of the Jesus movement after the crucifixion, so you're talking year 33, 40, somewhere in that range. But the triumph of Christianity steps back in time to set the religious context of what was going on during Jesus's time. Now, there are two important aspects to the religious world leading up to the time of Christ, and you make note of these. The first is Roman paganism and the emergent tendency toward monotheism. And the second is more specifically related to a monotheistic faith and its tendencies toward schism, and that is Judaism. I want to start with the latter because Jesus preached in an area that was predominantly Jewish. So what did Judaism look like at this time?
It was an enormous mess, if you will. There were many, many Judaisms, many of which hated one another. I mean, the Samaritans thought they were Jews, and the other Jews thought they weren't. In the midst of all this, there were zealots who were willing to assassinate people for not being sufficiently religious, at least as they defined it. They even murdered high priests who they felt were not sufficiently religious. And it was within this kind of a climate that Christianity appears, and it commits itself to claiming that a human who was crucified, for among other things, for claiming to be the Messiah, was the Messiah.
Mm-hmm.
And this in a Jewish world that found these claims completely unacceptable and, in fact, criminal.
Yeah, one could often just think about this in terms of the coming of the Messiah. You're thinking about major figures in the Bible like King David. Those are big historical figures. And here's this guy who, you know, is somewhat of a nobody, coming out claiming to be the Messiah, and he is crucified for this. This is not, I would expect, the image of what people in Judea at the time thought would be the Messiah.
Well, that's true, although there we now realize there were some themes. The Messianic expectations of Judaism at this point, again, were a complete fractured. I mean, there were 19 different theories of what the Messiah would be like. Some of them fit Jesus quite well, it turns out. We didn't know about much of it, but in the last 20 years or so, there have been some interesting discoveries along this line. There even, as a matter of fact, was a tradition of a Messiah who died and rose again from the dead. We're not quite sure whether this was a prediction before Jesus or was developed afterwards, but it was very clearly there in any event. If you look at this Judaism, and one of the things that I think is very important here is, you know, one of my earliest books was on Christian anti-Semitism, and one of the things that has always been of concern to good Christians has been the passages in the New Testament that are quite hostile to Jews. And it turns out I began to realize that there's been an enormous misunderstanding of these passages, that somehow we interpret them as the writings of this huge majority of Christians against this little tiny minority of Jews, but in fact, at the time they were written, there probably were no more than 3,000 Christians in the world, and there were from 10 to 15 million Jews. And what these writings represent in many ways was the fear that the Christian community in Jerusalem, where of course these things were written, were perhaps, you know, maybe 600-700 Christians in Jerusalem at the time, certainly no more. And they were very fearful because, in fact, they were periodically persecuted. People were executed. It wasn't just Jesus was crucified, but his brother was thrown out of a tower, and when that didn't kill him, then they stoned him to death. There were, Paul again and again confesses, participating in persecutions of Christians. This is not written about, and it certainly is easy to understand. I'm not sitting here trying to blame Jews for persecuting Christians. It was very likely they would have done so because they thought they were blasphemers.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is that if we don't take this into account, then we don't understand the whole situation in which early Christianity was trying to rise, and the fact that the Jewish persecutions of Christians were far, far more dangerous than the subsequent Roman persecutions, because the church was so tiny at the time.
Mm-hmm. And it was a very concentrated area at a very critical time in its history that it could go one way or the other. And again, that's, you know, this issue of persecutions, of majority religions persecuting minority religions, is something that's fairly common throughout history, and we should not be surprised that this was occurring around that time.
Oh, certainly not.
Yeah.
And of course, the fact is the Romans did subsequently persecute the church, but... Mm-hmm. But that was much less dangerous.
I want to come back to that issue of persecutions, because you write some very interesting things about martyrdom later on in the book. But I'm still sticking here with Judaism. And one of the things that I found very interesting in your writing of this book is that Judaism was rather schismatic at the time. It was breaking apart. You already mentioned the Samaritans, the Zealots, and you have the, you know, different priestly class here as well. We often tend to think of Judaism as just one big, huge religion that is fairly unified. Maybe in recent years you had the Reform movement break out, but, you know, back then, no, you didn't think of it too schismatic. So tell us a little bit about that schismatic nature of Judaism and why that mattered for Christianity at this time.
Well, I suppose in the beginning one could say that Christianity was one more of these schismatic movements within Judaism, because everybody in the early church was a Jew, was an observant Jew, and thought that you had to be Jewish in order to be a Christian. Remember the decision to let Paul seek Gentile converts who didn't have to also become Jews. That was a very radical step, a very surprising step, and probably the most important step in the whole history of Christianity, you know, subsequent to the Christ story. Without it, you have an ethnic religion. But there's a natural tendency for religions to break into separate factions if there's nobody sitting on them. In other words, in order to have one monopoly church to which everyone has to give credence, that's an unnatural condition. That's requires government repression. And still you will have all kinds of dissidents sneaking around on the sides, because the fact of the matter is all human populations have variety within them in terms of their religious taste. Some people want probably no religion. Some people always want a very permissive religion. Some people want a very strict religion. Some people want an extremely strict religion. This seems to be built into populations. You can even find it in primitive tribes. And if things are left to their own devices, you will have different religious organizations serving these quite disparate tastes, because one group, one organization can't do it. You can't have a church that is both very permissive and very restrictive.
Mm-hmm.
And Judaism, because they were ruled by the Romans, basically, who didn't care about their religious life, there was no repressive force to keep things into one kind of Orthodox Judaism. Consequently, things scattered, and there were many Judaisms. As it turns out, later in Rome, there were many paganisms. It's a matter of, if you will, religious freedom.
Let's move now to paganism that you brought that up. Christianity eventually spreads through the Roman Empire, and also you make a good point that it spreads eastward toward China, which a lot of people forget about. But let's stick with the Roman Empire here for a second. In doing so, in spreading throughout the Roman Empire, it runs into a religious landscape that wasn't altogether Jewish, but it was, I would say, pagan or maybe even possibly heavily pagan. What did the Roman religious landscape look like, as you term it, on Christmas Eve some 2,000 years ago?
Well, the fascinating thing about Roman religious culture is that there was a high degree of religious tolerance and freedom in the sense that the state did not subsidize any temples.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody had to fend for themselves. Consequently, there was a lot of competition. There was a lot of variety. And surprisingly, perhaps, Rome was much more religious than the other societies and cultures surrounding Rome. That is to say, most societies in those days were temple religious societies. There was a pagan religion that was subsidized by the state. They had various gods in various temples, but they were all part of the same package, and it was all paid for by the state. Not so in Rome. As a matter of fact, they didn't even have professional priests for the most part in Rome. These roles were played by prominent citizens who had very little training for the job. And there was an immense amount of variation and freedom. And moving into Rome, all kinds of religions from the East. Mithra, of course, was locally produced, but there was the religion of Isis and the religion of the Great Mother and all sorts of other groups moving into Rome and finding supporters. As a matter of fact, these Eastern faiths moving into Rome, if we look at them and chart their progress, they're a pretty good predictor of the path that the Christianity subsequently takes as it moves in and becomes strong within the empire. In other words, the cities that had temples to Isis first were also the cities that had Christian congregations first. But in any way, it was a great, huge mixture, and Rome was very permissive of it, with one exception, and that is Rome was very intolerant of congregationalism. As long as it was just a temple and people patronized the temple as opposed to belonging to the temple, that was fine. But if people got together in an organization that was exclusive, that perhaps was a little bit secretive, that had regular meetings and the people gave primary commitment to, that was not something that Rome was willing to tolerate. And long before Christianity came along, Rome was busy persecuting religions that it took a congregational form.
Now, that is really interesting, and you make some good points about why this is the case. And when I was reading it, I couldn't help but think of contemporary China as well, where the Chinese Communist Party is very concerned about Falun Gong, which right. To me, from the outside, you know, looks like a giant yoga movement that, you know, they gather on the lawn, they do some exercises, and it's all pretty peaceful. So why would the Roman Empire be concerned about these congregational movements, specifically Christianity, because, you know, they're starting to lump up? It seems like a fairly peaceful, benign religion.
Well, I'll tell you, there's something really interesting. Roman emperors believed that everyone was out to get them. And they had good reason for thinking that. Nearly all of them were murdered.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, dying a natural death was a real rarity for a Roman emperor. Consequently, they prohibited organizations. because they thought organizations would then turn into political movements or provide a basis for rebellion. Look, in the early in the second century, Pliny the Younger was out in the east somewhere in a town called Nicomedia, and they'd had a terrible fire. So he wrote a letter to the Emperor Trajan and asked for permission to form a volunteer fire department. And the Emperor turned him down. And we have both letters, his to the Emperor and the Emperor's letter coming back. And the Emperor says, look, no matter what the good intentions and the merits of these organizations, invariably they turn into political movements and I won't have it. When the followers of Isis wouldn't go to other temples and were busy holding their ceremonies, and people were coming to the temple, several times a week, that was a violation of the law.
Mm-hmm.
And the next thing you know, they crucified all the priests of Isis and tore down all the temples. Now, it didn't stick because they built them right back up again, and eventually Rome had more temples to Isis than to any other god. But the fact is that the Rome persecuted religions and ultimately persecuted the Jews for being a closed, highly committed, organized group. They were the Jews were kicked out of Rome several times. They were persecuted any number of times. One emperor put a bunch of his relatives to death for having Jewish ideas. It was an amazing time. You could get away with any kind of religion as long as you didn't get real serious about it.
Now, speaking of getting really serious about religions, monotheistic religions tend to do that. And yep. You just mentioned Isis, and the temples of Isis were becoming more and more popular within the Roman Empire at this time. And you make a very good point that there was a tendency to move toward monotheism within the pagan realm at this period of time. And this is going to help facilitate or at least open the door for Christianity as well, being a monotheistic and expansionary faith as compared to Judaism, which was monotheistic and more ethnically bounded. So what is it, first of all, what is it about monotheism that is attractive as compared to paganism? Because one would say, hey, if I can have 15, 20, 30 different gods to pick and choose from, that sounds like a pretty good deal. It's like a buffet at soup plantation or something like that. And second of all, how did this monotheism help pave the way for Christianity?
Well, first of all, I think people have a natural tendency to go the pagan way. Notice how many times the Jews backslid and started, worshiping the golden calf, this, that, and the other thing. There's a tendency to enjoy gods that are close, that are nearby, very human, and not morally demanding. I mean, the pagan gods didn't really care what people did as long as they appropriately propitiated them. They didn't care if you loved your neighbor or you divorced your wife. I mean, it wasn't of any interest to pagan gods. And, of course, that is their Achilles heel. There is no fundamental moral basis there for building a moral community. There's no basis, and also they're intellectually wanting. The marvelous thing about monotheism is that it gives an explanation. It explains kind of how the world happened and why the world runs and why sin is a bad thing, in ways that are simply out of reach for pagan faiths, and consequently, the Roman intellectuals favored more monotheistic religions. And the Isis movement and some of the others were kind of a semi-monotheism, but they couldn't quite, they exclusively went to the temples of Isis, for example. But they couldn't quite get to monotheism because she was placed within a pagan context that always admitted the existence of other gods, and including her divine son and this, that, and the other thing, and they couldn't quite break the deal, even though they were kind of a pseudo-monotheism. And it was paving the way in certain respects. And then of course the Jews had very clear and specific monotheism, but they also had it tied to an ethnicity. You had to not only become a believer in Jewish monotheism, you had to become a Jew. The thing about Christianity is that it was monotheism freed from ethnicity. Which, by the way, if you look around the world today, one of the staggering things about Christianity as we look back over the centuries is its flexibility culturally, its ability to perfectly be compatible with almost any culture. I mean, you know, the Bible's in about 2,000 languages, and there are Lord knows how many hundreds of thousands of separately incorporated Christianities there are around the world, all of which are sufficiently authentic.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that paganism does is it tends to absorb the gods that are around it. And in many ways, you saw this with the Germanic tribes that it broke down the Roman Empire in coming centuries. They were pagan, and they said, oh, you have this Christian thing. We'll just add that on the shelf here of these other gods we have. Why doesn't this go on in the Roman Empire in the first three centuries?
Well, it did.
Okay.
The Christians wouldn't have anything to do with it, but the pagans would. You know, if you go around later, after the rise, you know, after you've got medieval Europe, which is supposedly universally Christian, and you check it out, and you discover that that was a veneer that resting on top of a priestly class and the aristocrats, but if you got down in the villages and down with the peasants, Jesus had been added to the list. They were very weakly Christian, and sometimes really you shouldn't even be describing that. And, you know, you can find all kinds of things. There's something in the Icelandic Lana book, which is marvelous, that Thorleif believed in Jesus except in nautical matters,
mm-hmm.
Where he worshipped Thor.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Jesus except in nautical matters, and the guy was a sailor. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's there was a lot of that of adding Jesus to the list of gods and various figures that you invoke for this, that, and the other thing. And there's again where I suppose. One has to focus on the institution, because the institution of the church would have nothing to do with such a thing, of course. And the institution was very successful in baptizing kings and basically having political sovereignty,
mm-hmm.
that then trickled down in various ways. But there was an awful lot of just adding Jesus to the list of gods.
Now, as you say, baptizing kings and then getting the king's domain to subscribe to Christianity was fairly common in the medieval period. But back in the first couple centuries of Christianity, Christians had to really focus on converting both Jews and, as we mentioned earlier, Gentiles. Now, what specific advantages did Christianity have in there? And were there certain demographic features about both Jews and or Gentiles that gave Christians an advantage in being expansionary?
Well, you know, Paul Johnson has a wonderful line in his History of Christianity, which for a general book of the kind, I highly recommend.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Paul is a brilliant Englishman who's an amazing person. But in any event, he said they created a kind of a primitive welfare state within a society that had no social services. And so they did. There was a way in which, in a world suffering enormous miseries, the Christian church took care of its own. It looked after widows and orphans. It did feed the hungry. It did, during times of plague, nurse the sick. It was a religion of social responsibility to an immense extent, and this Roman philosophers held that one of the dirty concepts was mercy.
Mm-hmm.
that mercy was in fact a character flaw. That after all, mercy means extending benefits to people that they haven't earned. Christianity turned around and made it the primary virtue, a merciful God and a merciful society. And hence you did seek to care for others. And in a world that was suffering, I mean, let's face it, Roman cities were nightmares.
Yeah, that was something interesting in the book, and it's always an eye-opener for my undergraduate students who, you take a look at the pictures of the Roman Empire, and you see people dressed in pure white togas and on, you know, marble mausoleums and being fed grapes, and, you know, that life looks really good, and there's many political movements nowadays that harken back to the good old days of the Roman Empire when we didn't have SUVs belching out pollution into the air. It wasn't like that back then.
No, it was incredibly miserable. To the extent there was such a thing as sewers, they were little ditches running down the middle of the street, and the street was about 10 feet wide. It was a world of chamber pots, many of which were emptied out of second-story windows into the street during the night and hitting people. We know this because the Roman officials kept issuing new bulletins about the terrible punishment they were going to inflict on people who did this. It was a world without soap. It was a world full of crime. People didn't go out at night unless they went with a whole company of armed people, mm-hmm. because they were bad folks out there, yeah. in the dark. It was a terrible place, a terrible time. I mean, out in the country, things were a lot better, but the cities were dreadful places, full of disease. Let me give you a marvelous instance. Here we are at a time when people don't have photo IDs, right?
Mm-hmm.
So how do you prove who you are, and how do you sign legal documents and whatnot? Well, they wrote physical descriptions. And among these, they always would notice any visible scars that might help identify the person. And we have many documents, like bills of sale and various mortgages and whatnot that survived. And on overwhelmingly, almost everybody described in these documents has visible scars. We don't have that today.
Yeah.
This was about people getting infections. You get something going on your face, and it took it 2 years to clear up. And I mean, it was, or you had your arm lopped off, or whatever. It was visible illnesses were rampant.
And it was because of the tightness of which these cities were packed. I mean, these were densely packed cities for reasons of protection from outside invaders. So it wasn't, you know, far-flung, people spaced out with five-acre plots or anything. Disease spread through these towns and cities really quickly. And you have, you know, constant instances of plagues going on back and forth. And one of the parts of your book that I found enjoyable, not only in the most recent book, but in The Rise of Christianity, was how pagans dealt with plagues when they came through town and how Christians dealt with plagues. And this plays a pretty important role in the expansion of Christianity. So explain that if you could.
Well, the simple fact is that Christians nursed the sick. Pagans, because they didn't know any way to treat it, what they did is they basically tried to avoid all contact. People were pushed into the streets to die when they came down with something. People did everything possible to isolate themselves. I mean, the great famous Roman physician Galen, when a plague broke out in his lifetime, took off to his estate in the country and stayed there for 2 years until the plague had subsided. He didn't treat anybody.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, the Christians said, Hey, we say, this is the bishop in Egypt writing and saying, he said, look, let's not let pagans mock us. We believe that you don't die, that you ascend to heaven. And therefore, death is nothing to fear. And consequently, We shouldn't be cowering from these diseases. We should be treating people and helping people and doing what we can, because death is not a threat. Well, the interesting thing is, if in these great plagues and whatnot, very elementary nursing, just seeing the people had water and something to eat for a few days while they were desperately ill, would cut the death rates by as much as two-thirds.
Mm-hmm.
Which meant that during these plagues, Christians were surviving and pagans weren't. And not only that, but you created a great supply of Christians who were now immune because they'd had the disease and mm-hmm. lived through it.
That's the old chicken pox philosophy. Is
right.
Everyone...
So here are the Christians walking around almost, you know, in the midst of these great plagues, nursing the sick and surviving, and everybody could see it.
Mm-hmm.
And they took it as a miracle.
Yeah. You know, that's got to signal something and say, hey, I got this one religion, paganism, and everybody's dying and running away from me. Or I got Christianity where, wow, they're surviving and they're helping me.
Right.
It's a pretty easy choice there.
Right. And the other thing is, of course, if nothing else, the differential survival rates meant that at the end of the plague, there were the proportion of Christians to pagans had greatly increased, if no conversions had happened.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, as we may discuss later, Christian fertility was high compared to Roman fertility, and you know they were good. They could another way to outnumber them.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because that gets to the issue of women in the church. And when you look back today from the year 2012, especially when you have you know, a lot of studies about gender issues in the church, and looking at the medieval period, they say, oh, it's a guy-dominated thing. This wasn't necessarily the case in the first 300 years of the church. In fact, the Christian church was pretty women-friendly.
Yes, it was. As a matter of fact, and I've used this line in the book, but I like it. The real wonderment is why every pagan woman in the world didn't rush into the church.
Mm-hmm.
Christian women were so much better off. For one thing, this is perhaps in some ways the least of it, they were permitted substantial leadership roles in the church. Paul writes about deaconesses. There are deaconesses all over the place. And the deacons and deaconesses were very important officials in the church. And then, you know, Paul is always recommending Phoebe and this person and that person who have been so important to him and who are leaders in their congregations and whatnot. We owe it to the King James Version, by the way, to have missed this for a few hundred years, because they translated deaconess as deacon's wife. Because they didn't like the idea of all these women running around leadership positions. But deaconess it is, and it now remains. In any event, the advantages of Christian women were started at birth, like survival. The Romans did a lot of infanticide. And about 10 to 1, it was females that they left out to die. They kept the boys, killed the girls. We have somebody reconstructed 600 upper class families, the whole family, in you know, for several generations, and I think it was only 6 of these families that raised more than one girl. So, starting with that, then you've got the fact that in Rome, typically, marriage involved a middle-aged man and almost prepubescent girl. The pagan girls were getting married 10, 11, 12, 13, the guys 30, 40. Christian women weren't. 16 was getting on the low side, 18 was the norm. They were not marrying 30 and 40-year-old males. They were marrying men very close to their own age. Say, 18-year-olds were marrying 21-year-old males.
And that's got to be rather...
That reflected on, of course, the whole relationship in the marriage.
Right.
These old men who married 12-year-olds had nothing in common with them, didn't talk to them.
And by the time you get to be 18 as a woman, you're much more control of yourself and your environment and situation.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
And, but these little girls were abused is what they were.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no companionship. There was something else that went on, of course, and that was Roman women had, let's say pagan women, had a dreadful mortality rate, not just for, you know, women in those days often died in childbirth, but these Roman girls were dying in abortions. I mean, we're talking in an age without soap, let alone antibiotics. And abortions are very, I mean, modern technology, there's not much to it, but back in those days, you were actually reaching into the woman with a knife and cutting up the baby and pulling it out.
Mm-hmm.
It was enormously risky, and the mortality rate was extremely high. And you say, well, why did women do it? They didn't have the decision. The husband had the decision, for example, whether to kill the girl baby and keep the boy baby. That wasn't up to the wife. And it was up to the men to decide when and whether to abort. They made the decisions. And when the girl died, then they found themselves another 12-year-old, or not.
Mm-hmm.
The point is that pagan women had an awful lot. Christian women were so vastly much better off. And then there's divorce. Roman women were constantly being divorced. And Christian women, there was a real, really strong bias against divorce. Eventually, of course, got formalized into a complete prohibition.
Mm-hmm.
I was very, remember, Henry VIII got in real trouble trying to get himself divorced.
Yep.
Christians didn't much hold with divorce. Consequently, Christian women married men when they themselves were old enough to do so, men who were close to their age. They didn't suffer abortions. They didn't have to fear constantly for divorce. You had a very secure family life developing in the Christian community in contrast with the pagan communities where women were totally insecure.
Now, this, as you mentioned, has some demographic effects. One, you're going to have bigger families. They're going to survive much longer.
Oh, the Christian birth rate was much higher than the Roman. The Roman population was shrinking slowly.
Mm-hmm.
The lack of fertility.
Yeah, and you have that gender imbalance there that's going to cause problems.
There was a tremendous shortage of women.
Yeah.
There was estimated to be about 140 men for every 100 women.
Yeah, that's huge. The other thing that we know from studies of religion via sociologists, too, is that women are the ones who are usually more attracted to religious movements, and they're the ones that pull the men in. Is this what's going on then, too?
Yes. The early church was overwhelmingly female. Probably three to two as a minimum. And there are several reasons for it. One is that unless women are prohibited from joining, as they have been in Mithra, you know, occasional religion through the centuries. Women converts will always outnumber male converts. Women are more religious than men, more actively religious than men. In every society that we can look at around the world today, 160 nations, women attend religious services more frequently than men, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
There's been a lot of speculation as to why this is true, and we probably don't need to get into that here. But the fact of the matter is, there is that factor, and the additional factor that Christianity was so exceptionally attractive to women. It gave them so much more in the way of a life.
Yeah.
And between these two factors, the early church was quite heavily female. You know, you can look at Paul's letters. In one case, he addresses a letter to 18 men and 15 women who were leaders of the church in this particular community.
And when you think about the imbalance of men to women at that time, that 18 to 15 ratio is actually very favorable to women.
Oh, yeah, because presumably men were much more likely to have leadership positions than were women. And if it's only 18 to 15, it suggests that there was a huge imbalance of women in that congregation.
Yeah, yeah, relative to the general population.
And there were a lot of other things. There was the Romans once confiscated the contents of a Christian church And you know, they've got the stuff that they were going to distribute to the poor, and it's left, you know, it's surplus clothing and whatnot. It was something like, but you can, you know, the shoes and the clothes and whatnot could be sorted out as to gender.
Mm-hmm.
And it was something like 6 to 1 women's clothing.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Now, one
of a lot of other signs.
Now, one of the other demographic features, so we just talked about women here, but one of the other demographic features has to do with wealth.
Yeah.
And if you go back to the Beatitudes and you listen to Jesus's Sermon on the Mount, he's talking, blessed are the poor. And so everybody's figuring out, hey, this is a movement that is really going to resonate among the poor. And so Christianity is going to spread amongst the poor first and foremost. You make a very strong case that this isn't necessarily going on. So tell us about that.
Well, you know, everybody wants to take Paul's statement, not many of you were noble, not many of you were wise, not many of you, you know, were wealthy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Not many of you were of noble birth. And that was always taken to mean that it was a religion of the slaves and the lower classes. But that's not what he said. And there's a wonderful Australian scholar named Judge who pointed out back in the 60s that Paul did not say none of you were of noble birth, but not many of you, which means some were. And for a little obscure movement at this time, to have any people of noble birth would have been quite remarkable. There aren't that many people of noble birth in the whole empire.
Yeah.
And as a matter of fact, it's been known for a long time, but sociologists ignored it. Almost every religious movement that we know anything in detail about started with the privileged. Buddha not only was a prince, but of his first 60 converts, 55 were from the nobility, and the other 5 we just don't know about.
Mm-hmm.
And on and on and on like that. I mean, you know, for example, the Methodists, we like to think of them as a religion of you know, poor people in America, but it started where? At Oxford, with a bunch of very privileged Englishmen. This is typical. And I've written at some length about why, but in any event, it's pretty apparent from all kinds of clues now that the early church, in fact, spread among people of privilege. Now, a household would convert. You know, the wealthy person would bring in his whole household. But that means, of course, that there were plenty of slaves and servants and whatnot coming in that conversion, but the fact of the main remains that it was, in fact, a movement of privileged people for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
Stop and think about the Gospels. We've got about 3,000-4,000 Christians on earth at the time when they're written. Who were they written for? A bunch of illiterate slaves? And suppose that there's somebody around who can read, which was, in fact, pretty rare at the time. there were some people who could write, obviously. And in fact, they were writing for somebody, and that was other Christians, and most of whom I think we can assume could in fact read. There is even a case can be made that Jesus was from a privileged background. I mean, after all, his parents could do things like go to Jerusalem for Passover every year, which was not something that the ordinary family could afford. There's this passage in which Paul says that Jesus basically was once gave up all of this wealth that he might, you know, serve the people. And it's always assumed that this was a figure of speech, that this was a metaphor. But it's in a context where Paul is asking people for money.
Yeah.
And it makes better sense. I mean, surely one has to conclude that Jesus was trained as a rabbi. Well, you know, that isn't necessarily something that happens to carpenters.
Mm-hmm.
Was Jesus a carpenter? I think it unlikely. It only says so in one passage of the New Testament. The other Gospels do not say he was a carpenter.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple of Jewish scholars claim that the word carpenter in that context was a word that applied to a scholar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I found that chapter to be really interesting, the chapter about Jesus' life and the issue about carpenters. Was he a carpenter? Was he a trained rabbi? One of the other things you mentioned as a possibility was that sometimes rabbis had secondary trades.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Well, I mean, you know, Paul was a tent maker.
Mm-hmm.
He makes so much out of working at his trade once in a while that it sounds like he wasn't really a tent maker.
In
the sense that a real tent maker wouldn't go around saying, "Hey, I made some tents last week."
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But, there was a long tradition of that. It's still there, by the way. There was a man named Martin Wolins who was chairman, dean, indeed, of the social welfare school at Berkeley. Wonderful man. When he was young, his father took him over and in New Jersey and had him trained as a chicken sexer.
Mm-hmm.
So that he would have a trade to fall back on.
Yeah.
if other things failed.
I think that might be good advice for our graduate students nowadays.
Yes, indeed. But you know, this is a long tradition in Judaism.
Mm-hmm.
And it all kind of fits together. And, you know, and maybe I'm wrong, but it's worth thinking about.
Yeah, it certainly is. One of the other things that you noted too, and this struck me as something that I never really realized, when it comes to the wealth aspect of the spread of Christianity, or the fact that it did spread among the privileged class, was that folks like Paul, as a missionary, actually traveled with a pretty big group, and you had to fund that group. When you read, you know, Paul's letters, and you just think of, well, it's just Paul, the guy going around. Maybe Barnabas is with him at some points in time, but they actually traveled with a pretty big cohort of several dozen, maybe up to 100 people at times.
Yeah,
right?
Yes, that's true. I mean, he always had a bunch of scribes with him to write everything down. We even know the name of one of them because at the end of one of Paul's letters, where he's greeted all of these people, the scribe says, "And I too, writer of this letter, greet you." Yeah, it was a big operation, and notice he always stayed in a home of some wealthy sponsor. You know, they weren't out sleeping in the chicken coops or something. They moved into a city, and it was like a great revival campaign. It was well organized ahead, and it was sponsored.
Mm-hmm. One of the last things that I want to deal with here, and there's so much more in this section of the book that I urge people to really pick it up, and it's an eminently readable book. But the one thing that has always fascinated me is the issue of persecutions. And we mentioned the Jews early on, Paul being one of them, or Saul when he was called Saul, persecuted the Christians. But then the Romans persecuted the Christians as well. There's a number of on and off again persecutions, Diocletian persecution, or I'm getting the names mixed up here now, but a number of different persecutions here. One would think that this would serve to stamp out Christianity. You make a case, on the other hand, that martyrdom within the church actually acted as a catalyst for recruitment. Explain that.
The really, you know, this has troubled social scientists, various intellectuals for centuries. Is how do you explain how they did it? How was it possible for these people not to recant? I mean, the punishments were grotesque, you know, putting people in a frying pan, and, you know, you do it in the Colosseum in front of, you know, this huge crowd. And, of course, they've been coming up with all kinds of notions. These people were all masochists and, you know, whatnot.
Yeah, the important thing, I just have to mention, you mentioned that word recant. when we talk about persecutions, a lot of people think, well, they were just rounded up and then thrown to the lions. They were rounded up and say, okay, you can either A, recant your faith, say you're no longer a Christian, and you go free, no problems. Or B,
even just do the pagan sacrifice that you were being picked up for refusing to do.
Yeah, and it would seem a fairly easy choice is, you know, you either get the lions or you can recant, and a lot of people chose proverbially the lions.
Yeah, well, the fact is, of course, let's not overlook, tons and tons of people did recant.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, because they were human.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of people didn't, and they underwent devastating punishments, and they endured them quite remarkably.
Mm-hmm.
What's been missed, it seems to me, although some very good people have been paying some attention to this issue in the last 20, 30 years, is that, first of all, there was an enormous reward structure built around being a martyr. You were treated as a celebrity, very often, by the way, it would be weeks or months before your martyrdom would actually occur, during which you were often treated as a celebrity by the Christians who were allowed to come and visit you. And Rome was very peculiar. Tried to destroy the church by persecution, but it persecuted from the top down and pretty much left the people alone. This would have destroyed the pagan temples, which consisted of priests and not much of anybody else. In Christianity, every time they killed a bishop, there were 15 guys stepping forward to take the job. It was a bottom-up organization in that sense, that it went all the way down. But the fact of the matter is that there was an enormous cult of saints, as it's been called, which is, martyrs knew that they would be celebrated pretty much forever in the Christian community for having done this. And they knew that because the names of martyrs were constantly brought up and revered and remembered and celebrated at the time. They knew they were going to join the ranks of those, that their name was going to be on the list. And secondly, of course, they didn't believe they were going to die. They did think they were going to be welcomed into heaven. And they believed that by having ascended into heaven as martyrs, that they were going to be sitting on a higher place, that there were real rewards for doing this.
Mm-hmm.
So if you really want to be materialist or something about this, you say, hey, these people thought that there were huge benefits for putting up with this, for enduring this. On top of which, they did it on stage. They did it in front of audiences. Many in the audience in a position to marvel at their courage and at their commitment and at their achievement. And it's amazing what people can do under these circumstances.
Yeah. And I think from the audience side, as well, in trying to help explain the expansion of Christianity, that martyrdom, the willingness to go voluntarily into the Colosseum to face your doom, has a very subtle or perhaps not so subtle signal about the quality of the religion. You're sitting in the audience and you're saying, well, you know, I don't know if I could put myself in that position, but wow, that person up there is really willing to die for their faith. It must be pretty good.
It must be valuable. That's right. Boy, I wouldn't do that. I mean, I'm sorry, Jove hasn't got me in his grasp like that. And you look there and you marvel. He says, you know, what's this? What's there? What's the prize? Yes, it was most amazing, and it did matter.
Mm-hmm. Which is pretty neat.
The whole package works.
Yeah,
all era. You know, it was an amazing time. But
Now, there are a few things that we haven't had the opportunity to talk about. And again, I'm going to recommend people pick up your book, The Triumph of Christianity, because there's things about the conversion of Gentiles, the God-fearers, and a number of other aspects in the book. And as you mentioned, it's a whole package. A lot of things came together at this point in time. I want to close off here, though, with the ending of this era, after 300 or so years of Christian growth, with the conversion of Constantine. And I'm hoping that we could close off with this, with the expectation that you'll come back in a couple weeks and explain what happens after Constantine. But what happens at that moment with Constantine's conversion and then essentially the Edict of Milan?
Well, the conversion of Constantine was a mixed blessing, but for the most part, unfortunate. The blessing part initially is, of course, he ends all the persecutions, as he had, of course, long since ended them in the portion of Rome that he'd been ruling over before he became the emperor of the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, of course, he's celebrated in church history for having showered all of these wonderful benefits on the church. I mean, bishops suddenly were grandees on the level of senators. He built churches like mad, and not old converted houses turned into churches, which is what had been true up until the time, conversion of Constantine. He started building cathedrals, if you will. He used his model was the imperial throne room palaces that were built for the emperor around he modeled churches on them.
Mm-hmm.
And he built churches all over. And his mother built churches in the Holy Land. And you know, he showered all these benefits and blessings on the church, and in doing so, darn near destroyed it. In the sense that suddenly, the church was such a good deal that there was a stampede into the priesthood by the sons of the affluent.
Mm-hmm.
People were becoming bishops who had been Christians for about a week. There were people who were made bishops who had never even been a priest, and got baptized after they became a bishop. You know, things like this were going on left and right. And the result was to create two churches. One was, I called, the Church of Power, and the other the Church of Piety, because at the same time, the monastic movement was booming as well. And it was also bringing in many sons and daughters of the privileged, and particularly the nobility. And the Church of Power was all of these people who eventually, you know, were the bishops. They ran the church. And some of them were, of course, pious men. Many of them were not so impious, but just weren't very religious, but they were just practical, worldly men. And then there were a bunch of them who were dreadful. There were people appointed popes who were incredibly immoral, so immoral and some of them had to be bought off to get them to leave the papacy. But the fact is that all of this started with Constantine, because suddenly, instead of a bishop being some guy who'd risen and had a minor little income from the parishioners, suddenly the state was showering all this money on the church, and it was bad for the church. And the second thing is, he decided that he was the 13th apostle, and
mm-hmm.
he interested himself in doctrine, and he introduced vicious intolerance into the church. It was he who started persecuting people for having wrong Christian doctrines. And that was something that got started in the church and has been one of the great curses in the history of the church, and that is the intolerance of theological differences.
Well, let me go ahead and leave it at that. And again, we're only roughly a quarter of the way through your book here. So if I could ask you, would you be willing to come back and talk about the medieval church and what happens after Constantine up through, say, the Luther's Reformation or Schismatic movement?
Sure, I'll come back.
Awesome. Well, very great. That was very good, Rod. And I will thank you for being on Research on Religion this week.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.